Today on the 21st Show, there are deep divides in American politics, but one thing a lot of people agree on is their distaste for white liberals. Conservatives think they're left-wing nut jobs. Progressives think they're corporate shills, and many people of color are suspicious that they're, at best, tepid allies. All this is the subject of a new book by Illinois-based historian Kevin Schultz. It's called Why Everyone Hates White Liberals, Including White Liberals. I'm Brian Mackey, and that's coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WNIJ in Rockford DeKalb, WVIK in the Quad Cities, and WSIU in Carbondale. But first, news. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And today is primary election day in Illinois. Polls are open until 7 this evening. You can find our extensive election coverage at our website. We've got interviews with almost all the men and women running for Senate, as well as a handful of other high-level office seekers. That's all at 21stshow.org. Today, as we've done on several past election days, I want to take a deeper dive into a political topic, but one that's at a higher level than the news of the day. So for the hour, we're going to be talking about white liberals. Now, what was your reaction when I said that phrase just now, white liberals? What sort of person do you think I'm describing? My guest today is the historian Kevin Schultz, and he says there's no single widely agreed upon definition. Rather, it's a Rorschach test of one's own political allegiances. Schultz writes, "If you think white liberals are quasi-communists, elitists eager to indoctrinate your children in predatory sex schemes and turn social services into mechanisms of perpetual dependency, then you are likely a conservative who respects Tucker Carlson and watches Fox News or One American News Network." He goes on to say, "If you think white liberals are mostly beards for the corporate order, too wimpy to advocate real change, NIMBYs cloaked in progressive verbiage, then you're likely a progressive who thinks Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has some good points and David Graeber was one of America's great thinkers." And then he says, "If you think white liberals are fake friends who fail to show up in times of need, who use nice words but don't recognize microaggression or the power of structural racism, then you likely sympathize with minoritized communities and may even be a civil rights activist, looking up to people like Lorraine Hansberry, James Baldwin, and Ibram X. Kendi." So what really is a white liberal? How did we go from a time when half of Americans identified as liberal after the New Deal and World War II to a time when even many liberals shrink from the term? And what should people who embrace the ideas behind being a liberal do about it? All that is the subject of Kevin Schultz's most recent book. It's called Why Everyone Hates White Liberals, Including White Liberals. Schultz is a professor in history, religious studies, and Catholic studies at the University of Illinois Chicago. He's also a past president of the Society for U.S. Intellectual History. His previous books include Buckley and Mailer, The Difficult Friendship That Shaped the 60s, and Tri-Faith America, How Catholics and Jews Held Postwar America to Its Protestant Promise. Kevin Schultz, welcome to the 21st Show. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Brian. What a great introduction. And it's election day. We get to see democracy on the march out there. It's really fun. And then you quote back to me some of my favorite sentences. I've written some bad sentences, but I like the ones that you wrote back to me. So
those are very good.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks for being here. I also have to compliment you. I know you didn't do it, but the design of the book is just so great for listeners who won't be able to see it. It's got this mirror surface that I don't think I've ever seen that in a book before. But when you look at it, good chance you're going to see yourself reflected back.
Yeah, this was the people at University of Chicago Press came up with this, and they showed it to me, and they had to explain it to me just like you explained it to listeners. And I laughed as soon as I heard about it. And then I showed people, and they sort of didn't get it. And then all of a sudden, they would hold it at just the right angle, and they'd see themselves reflected in the title. And then they would start laughing, too. So good job to the design team.
100%. All right, listeners, you can join us throughout the hour today at 800-222-9455. I want to know what the political category liberal means to you. And maybe if you've ever identified as a liberal. And what do you think of this disdain for white liberals we're going to be talking about today? Join us at 800-222-9455. Maybe you share some of that disdain. 800-222-9455. All right, let's start with the history, as you do in the book. Before FDR, what is the meaning of the word liberal?
So, great question. Liberal had several iterations. Words change over time, and the word and meaning of liberal changed over time. So when I studied this and read other historians who had sort of described this, I realized that the word liberal derives originally from the Latin word liber, which means free. And so that concept of individual freedom always sits at the foundation of what it means. But what is oppressing us changes and has changed over history. And so the word liberal has changed with the changing oppressor. So, for instance, I have this little time in the book where paragraph where I talk about the history of it and a brief capsule, if listeners will allow me to sort of nerd out here. I start going back to Shakespeare's time, where liberal meant sort of generosity of spirit, generosity of money even. You were sort of welcoming of other people. You were free of sort of inviting other people in. But then the word liberal sort of took on some religious meaning when the power of the church, especially the Catholic Church, but definitely strong-arm Protestantism as well, the power of religions seemed to be imposing upon people's freedoms. So to be a liberal in the 17th and 18th century shifted meanings from being generous of spirit to actually being more of a free thinker, someone who believed in freedom of thought, freedom of religious expression, and at least freedom of allowing other people to believe in what they wanted to. We shouldn't necessarily imprison people for being Jewish or imprison Protestants for not honoring the power of the Pope or whatever it might be, depending on who's in power. So religious freedom really was signified what it meant to be liberal in the 17th and 18th century. But then in the 18th and 19th century, it shifted again because this was the era of revolutions, the time of the American Revolution and the French Revolution and revolutions all across Latin America. And so then the oppressors seemed to be the political power of kings and queens. So liberalism again shifted meaning to signify a belief in the sense, the notion that we should have a say in who is the governor over us. We should have a say in what kind of laws dictate what society we live in. So it shifted from sort of religious freedom to political freedom. And that's when our country was founded. Then we get another shift, and this is where most people in today's society have their understanding of what liberal is, or at least the foundation of it. And that happens in the late 19th and early 20th century. And I pinpoint this summer of 1932 when Franklin Delano Roosevelt is trying to figure out a way to talk about this new power that is oppressing individuals and taking away their freedoms. And this was the power of big business. This is in the aftermath of the Industrial Revolution and the rise of big corporations and US Steel and the rise of banks and the corporate order. And all of a sudden it seems like there's this oligarchic wealthy class that is able to control politicians and politics. And so we need something that is pushing back, that is preserving individual freedoms. And so it starts in Britain, but it takes off in the United States in the 1930s when liberalism comes to mean using the power of government to push back on the business power of the oligarchs and the one percenters. Franklin Roosevelt called them the economic royalists. And liberals were those who were trying to use the federal or state government to push back against those who would oppress and take away our freedoms. And those people were the rich one percenters and the corporate order. And we've had that sort of definition ever since. When you think about what a liberal is today, at least in some foundation, no matter if you're coming from the left or from the right, you tend to think of it as the use of the federal government and use of the regulatory power of the state to push back on big business.
So you, in fact, identify FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, as the first white liberal. I hadn't made this connection until I was just listening to you now. You know, there was a liberal party in England before that. That wasn't a great success. I read a book once, The Strange Death of Liberal England. In fact, that's one of my favorite history books of all time. But why does FDR come to embrace liberal as the term for what he's trying to do?
Well, I'm going to correct you a little bit with history.
Please
nerd
do.
Stuff.
Please
it was a great success in Britain. I mean, it had to fight for for to push back against the power of big business. But it was this great success, you know, not only ending slavery in the British Empire, but also reforming the state to embrace more transformative changes, including outlawing child labor laws and pushing. Sometimes it lined up with the Labor Party to push back against the power of big business. It never really took off in the United States, though, because it got aligned in interesting ways. If you want to read the book in chapter one, I go into this a little bit, but it got aligned with free thinking and free love and all of this radical rejection of Protestant morality. And so to be a liberal in the United States was to be sort of radical in that kind of atheistic, free love, amoralistic kind of way. And so no politician wanted to touch that in the 1890s and in the early 1900s. Some people tried to use it in the 1910s and 1920s, but nobody really had a fixed definition until 1932. And for listeners, you might remember back to what was going on in 1932. It was the Great Depression. And you'll recall your high school history and maybe your college history if you took those history classes in college to the New Deal. And a lot of people, when Franklin Roosevelt talked about his New Deal, were calling him a socialist or a communist. And they were trying to dismiss this as too far to the left of any centrist notion of what American politics could be. So he was looking for a word that would replace socialism or would defang his enemies and take away their attacks on him. And so the word that he gave, he stumbled on it in a speech in 1932. He said, "We must defend the liberal order of things. We must pursue the march for liberalism." And all of a sudden, the crowd responded in this speech. And so the next day, he used the word liberalism a little bit more in his speech. And by the end of his campaign in the summer of 1932, all of a sudden, he was leading this fight for liberalism that we now know of as the New Deal. And one of his advisors, I love this story that I was able to dig up, one of his advisors, Rex Tugwell, who was sort of really interested in how we could market this transformation in the way governments operated in relationship to our citizens. He said, "Franklin, how did you come up with liberalism?" And Franklin Delano Roosevelt just sort of raised an eye and he said, "Does it matter that much?" And that's the best we can get as to why he picked this word. But we can deduce that it sat really comfortably between sort of socialism and communism on the left. And what else he was seeing in the 1930s, which was the sort of rise of authoritarianism that he was seeing in Italy and in Germany later on. And he was trying to come up with a centrist way to save capitalism, but regulate it so that it would have more beneficial rewards for people throughout society and not just enriching those at the top.
So yeah, talk more about that, the idea that preserving capitalism is core to what he's doing here. And I guess that is really where it, because I think in the popular imagination, you hear people use the word liberal, socialist, a lot of that, you know, it just kind of gets lumped together and, you know, on talk radio and that sort of thing. How is capitalism the key to what FDR is trying to do?
Yeah, this is what you'd referred to as sort of the great success of the right in since the 1950s all the way to today, is to say that liberalism, which was this sort of centrist political philosophy that, as you referred to, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was actually trying to save capitalism from its worst, most greedy ethos, and the right has sort of pushed liberalism all the way to the left to equate it basically with socialism. But that's not at all what Franklin Delano Roosevelt was trying to do. He was trying to preserve the banks. I mean, that was one of the first things he did was go on a 4-day bank holiday. This was the first executive order he signed, was to stop the runs on banks. And then he took a bunch of financially backed capital and put laws into place that would preserve the banks, not have them taken over by the state like was happening in other parts of the world, but in fact allow the sort of capitalist control and capitalist flow of money to continue, but with regulations and with protections of the federal government. When Franklin Delano Roosevelt wants to go and reform the housing industry, he doesn't want to build a bunch of state-controlled apartments like they were doing in Moscow, for instance. But instead, his reforms in the housing world end up building more apartments, but then also going on to build single-family homes in the suburbs with his, especially in the 1940s and 1950s. So Roosevelt, from the very beginning, disappoints a lot of people on the left, a lot of the more radical leftist voices who thought, "Yay, capitalism is over, and its time has come and gone, and now we can embrace some sort of socialism. Those people turned against Franklin Delano Roosevelt when they saw what he was doing was actually rehabilitating capitalism, but regulating it and creating some safeguards so that it couldn't be subjected to its own most greedy actors.
We have just a couple of minutes before we need to take a break, but talk a little bit about the time in American history when it seemed like the New Deal and liberalism were simply now the way America was, right? More than half of Americans identified as liberal. I don't know if you'd call this a triumph or a detente or a misunderstanding, or take it where you will.
Yeah, no, I mean, so Franklin Delano Roosevelt uses this word in 1932 and redefines it in the meaning that we all sort of have today, with this notion that the federal government has significant responsibility to protect its citizens, to provide freedom for its citizens from the power of big business and oligarchs who are using their money to impose their will. So that's sort of what he means. And the New Deal, as fraught and contested as it was incredibly successful. And Franklin Delano Roosevelt was a master politician who could articulate his vision with his famous fireside chats that we all hear about. I mean, this was a president who a lot of American families would put his portrait up in their home because of his various New Deal programs, save them from the ravages of poverty, save them from the breadlines, put them to work, gave them jobs. And then in the 1940s, he helped fight World War II and led the country into the battle over Hirohito and Hitler and all over totalitarianism. So a lot of Americans really did embrace Franklin Delano Roosevelt and his vision for liberalism. But more than just the cult of personality or charisma, he was also doing significant things that we saw the fruits of in the 1940s, 1950s, and 1960s. Despite the shortcomings of those eras, which we've been hearing about, restrictions on black rights, which led to the civil rights movement, restrictions on women's rights, which led to the women's rights movement, all of these unbelievably justifiable moments. Nonetheless, in the 1940s and 1950s, we do see this tremendous expansion of the middle class. It was the fattest middle class the American state has ever had. And the most Americans by percentage were part of that middle class. So, despite your problems that many people have with post-World War II liberalism, it was in effect creating this broad middle class that was welcoming more people into the fold. So, it was relatively successful. So, it's no accident that so many Americans saw liberalism as a way
And
not to fight.
embrace the identity for themselves. Absolutely. All right, we need to take a break. We're going to continue with Kevin Schultz. The book is Why Everyone Hates White Liberals, Including White Liberals. 800-222-9455. This is The 21st Show. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and we are talking today, primary election day in Illinois. Polls are open till 7. We're talking with Kevin Schultz, a professor in history, religious studies, and Catholic studies at UIC, the University of Illinois Chicago, and also the author of the book, came out last year. It's called Why Everyone Hates White Liberals, Including White Liberals. We asked members of our texting group what you thought about some of these questions. We heard from Tom in Downers Grove, who said, "I proudly describe myself as a bleeding heart liberal. There's nothing wrong in showing empathy for your fellow human beings." But Jesse in Mattoon said, "When I think of the term liberal, I think of highly astute intellectuals that are typically from extremely wealthy, traditionally conservative families that ride the coattails of their rich family but defy the political beliefs. Progressive policies are well-defined and plausible. Liberal policies are usually for very small factions and are typically incompatible with reality. I've always identified as progressive," Jesse says, "and do tend to use liberal as a derogatory remark." What do you think? 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. All right. Back in 2003, the conservative Club for Growth ran this ad against Howard Dean, who was then the governor of Vermont, but was becoming a progressive favorite in the Democratic presidential primary.
What do you think of Howard Dean's plans to raise taxes on families by $1,900 a year?
What do I think? Well, I think Howard Dean should take his tax hiking, government expanding, latte drinking sushi eating, Volvo driving, New York Times reading,
body piercing, Hollywood loving, left wing freak show back to Vermont, where it belongs.
Got it?
Club for Growth Pack is responsible for the content of this advertising.
All right, Kevin Schultz, how do we get from William F. Buckley to that?
Oh, that's a straight line right there. By the way, before I answer it, the listeners are so smart. They were such articulate voices. That was really great to hear. But to go from, you know, William F. Buckley and the right-wing critique of liberalism to what you just heard about these elitist, snobby liberals who are trying to dictate from those coasts, or maybe even the third coast, what the rest of America, the good middle American, should do, is a relatively straight line. As soon as, you know, we talked before the break about how liberalism was sort of triumphant in the 1940s and 50s and even into the 1960s. But there were these attacks that were coming. You know, anytime there's a political movement that is successful, people are going to attack it right away. And William F. Buckley really headed up this attack from the right. He said, you know, liberalism, and he started calling it the liberal establishment, which we might have heard. That's William F. Buckley's phrase. He often capitalized the L and the E in the hated liberal establishment. They basically were just quasi-socialists who were trying to use liberalism as a way to take away free enterprise economics and bring about communism, and then centralize control of your life in Washington, D.C. with these gigantic regulatory agencies that were going to tell you what to do. They knew how to live better than you do. This was in the pages of National Review, his magazine, which is, of course, still publishing, although William F. Buckley died in 2007, 2008, I think late 2007. But nonetheless, this sort of critique has been constant from the right. And as it has grown all the way to today and to the election of Donald Trump, where he made his signature sort of move, owning the libs or triggering the libs or making the libs cry, all of which he said during his campaign, it was to continue this sort of resentment against Washington, D.C. or the bureaucratic state or those who might think they know how to live your life better than you. So there is this long line of right-wing critique against liberalism as these elitist snobs, these latte-drinking Volvo driving. I can't remember all the stuff that appeared in that Howard Dean ad, but it's all pretty consistent all the way from the 1950s to the 19 to today. One really interesting thing about that ad, though, is that Republicans had a problem, and they still in a lot of ways have a problem, which is whenever they poll people about liberal ideas, whether that's Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, some basic regulations on banks, some basic regulations on the stock market and things like that, Americans widely love these liberal initiatives. So Americans don't hate liberalism as an idea. But instead, what the Republicans have done as a masterstroke is, let's attack liberals. Let's go after their latte drinking elitism. Let's go after their bureaucratic sensibility. Let's go after their snootiness and their Volvo driving and their lack of skin in the game. And that way we can undercut liberal ideas, which are wildly popular, by making fun of white liberals themselves. And this has been remarkably successful in a lot of ways. And we've seen it actually come to fullest fruition in the last, I don't know, 10 years with MAGA Republicans sort of controlling all aspects of our government.
All right. I think this is a good time. Let's go to the phones, and we may get a call on that very point. Paul is calling from Carbondale, 800-222-9455, if you want to join us. Paul, thanks for calling in.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. So as a person with more conservative lean and some very progressive bound, also like bounding that way as well when it comes to like care for the earth and many other issues, I've had to roll my eyes over the years, and I think something that makes liberals feel so cool about being liberal and also makes everyone else roll their eyes is how it became the party of cool, how it became like, well, you know, the Hollywood elite supports liberalism, and it kind of solidified this understanding of people who really don't need to care as to how an election turns out because they're multimillionaires, they're liberals because it's cool and we can all high-five about it, where people who actually have to be concerned about where the country's going vote with more conservative values. And I don't know where, because, you know, the speaker who I'm really enjoying is absolutely right, where it does seem like it's a bunch of Uggs and wheatgrass and lattes and Volvos and everything else. And it's like, okay, trust fund babies, I understand that you think it's cool to like high five the Hollywood elite, But sometimes you need to look at the more conservative values as well for the future of the nation.
Good stuff, Paul. I appreciate the call. Thanks for doing that. Thanks for listening. What do you think of that, Kevin Schultz?
I think liberals back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s sort of backed themselves into this corner in a lot of ways. As manufacturing was declining in the United States and people were buying cars from Asia and from Europe rather than the United States, and we saw sort of the auto industry decline, liberals and Republicans for the most part also, they didn't really have a good answer for this kind of transformation, except for let's vote for technology, let's go embrace Silicon Valley ideas. And that pushed the Democratic Party in the direction that this caller is suggesting, which is sort of more towards the educated, the more elite. And then all, of course, some of these dot-com people became billionaires. And so then these wealthy people. And what's fascinating, two things about this call is fascinating, is that right at this moment that I'm talking about in the 70s, this became the Republican Party's strategy. They said, we don't even want California and New York. Instead, let's use California and New York as the focus of resentment for the great silent majority, was Nixon's phrase for it, or middle Americans was the Republican strategist for it. And let's get the votes of the Southerners and the Midwest. And if we can get all of those votes, we don't even need those coasts. So let's start making fun of them as elitists. Let's start making fun of them as latte drinking people who are out of touch. And the Democrats never really had a response. So part of the caller's framing of this is something that the Republican Party has crafted, has forced us or invited us to believe. It's sort of a great marketing move by the Republicans. And I would simply add one other point is the interesting thing is, if you can think of one president, the only American president who's ever marched on the front lines with union workers, you might be surprised to think that it wasn't a Republican who gets a lot of votes from the working class, but it was Joe Biden just a few years ago who marched with the UAW. So there is some disconnect between the image of what people have when they think of liberals and who liberals might actually be.
One of the other groups you identify, and let me just remind listeners, we're speaking with Kevin Schultz, UIC professor and the author of Why Everyone Hates White Liberals, Including White Liberals. You can join us at 800-222-9455. One of the other groups you identify as being suspicious of white liberals are civil rights leaders. Now, I'm going to read, you cite the letter from a Birmingham jail by Martin Luther King. I'm going to read a little bit here. He says, I've almost reached the regrettable conclusion that the Negro's greatest great stumbling block in his stride toward freedom is not the white citizens' counselor or the Ku Klux Klanner, but the white moderate, who is more devoted to order than to justice, who prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice, who constantly says, I agree with you in the goal you seek, but I cannot agree with your methods of direct action. Talk about the frustration of civil rights leaders with white liberals.
Yeah, I mean, Black Americans have had a long, many hundred year long history of being frustrated with white people, white leaders, white citizens who claim to be on their side and to fight for their civil rights, their equal rights, their economic justice, their social justice. And then when the push came to shove and it came time for the battle to actually happen, those white moderates looked at maybe their nice homes and looked at their security and looked at their families and said they did not want to risk those things. They didn't want to actually engage in real battle for other people's freedoms. And there was this brief moment that we talked about after World War II, when it seemed like, and this was Martin Luther King's coming of age period, when it seemed like white moderates or white liberals might actually be ready to push for civil rights justice. I mean, the Brown v. Board of Education case, which led to the desegregation of schools, or at least mandated the desegregation if it didn't quite lead to the desegregation of schools, which mandated the desegregation of schools, was in 1954, and it was a unanimous decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. When the opportunity came about for President Truman and and even President Eisenhower to embrace some racial change, say desegregate the armed services. This happened in 1952. So when Martin Luther King was coming of age, he thought, ah, maybe this will be the moment when white liberals will be ready to fight for black justice. And then as the course of the civil rights movement picked up momentum and the struggle became more violent, if we talk about the bus boycotts and if we talk about the sit-in movements that happened in 1960 and 1961, and then if we get to the marches on Selma and things like that, then all of a sudden we see white liberals saying, now it's time for us to slow down this push. Right when things are actually starting to happen, many white liberals were saying, oh, so let's slow down because I don't want to risk what I've already had. And the kinds of rewards that we want to promise you, they're things that are going to happen in the future. And Martin Luther King and many other black activists grew incredibly frustrated, reaching back to 200 years of frustration and all the way pushing forward to today at what you said when Martin Luther King was just frustrated by white liberals who said all the right things, but when it came down to give up some of their sort of benefits of society, of being white in society, they were unwilling to do it. And we still see that today. I mean, this is Ibram X. Kendi's argument in his anti-racist talk. It's the same sort of argument we get from a lot of black activists. And black activists from the 1960s really set the model for women's activists that come up quite, you know, a few years after the black activists, or even Palestinian activists that we're seeing today. They don't necessarily trust the white liberal to be on their side.
Do you hear echoes of this argument today, where you have some in the Democratic establishment saying, look, you know, Republicans and conservatives are making a big issue of, say, trans rights, for example, or athletic participation, which is a super, super, super minority issue, right? The number of kids is like maybe a couple of dozen, even in a state like Illinois, that are affected by this. And Democrats are saying, you know what, we're not with the majority of Americans. Let's move beyond that, versus other Democrats or progressives saying, no, we're not going to throw people under the bus, so to speak. Do you hear echoes of that today?
Oh, 100%. Absolutely. This is sort of a continual argument from those who are mandating or demanding more radical change than traditional society. So yes, if it's like you use the example of trans kids, and yes, this is exactly the argument that we're having. We need to slow down, say, some more moderate voices or white liberals, and we need to study this more. We need to educate society about the fact that trans is just a modifier of women, just like tall or short or whatever it is that the language of education goes. So yes, this is a constant refrain that we have. I will say one thing that comes up that is most striking to me is if you study the past like I do, you realize that the most transformative changes we've had in the American past occur when those moderate voices and those more radical voices are able to put down arms against each other and unite to push back against whatever the imposing powers are. So I think, again, back to the time in the 1930s, when under the charisma of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, he was able to win the votes of the more radical voices and win the votes of the more moderate voices, and together they were able to push back and create significant amounts of change. This also happened in the 1950s and 1960s in the Civil Rights Act. Activism. So when those two parties, the moderates and the more radical voices, are able to find some rapprochement and come together, that's when more radical changes happen. But I do think those tensions are always there in exactly the way that you described them.
All right, I'm going to read a few more messages we got from listeners. And if you've called in, we have to take a break in a couple of minutes. Stay on the line, please. We'll get to your call after the break. But a few more people embracing liberal. Terry in Batavia says, I identify as a left-leaning liberal. She puts identify in quotes there. Says, I'm a childless cat lady as well. In the Clinton era, it was latte liberal, and that fit as well. I seek out liberals. They're my tribe. All we collectively want is to make this country better for all its people. Christopher in Brimfield likewise said, I consider myself a liberal. I'm not ashamed of it. Being liberal is forward thinking. Conservative is backward thinking. I'd rather think forward. And Chris in Rock Falls says, nothing means what it used to. Conservatives are extreme. The don't tread on me crowd has no problem with treading on others. Some Christians act so hatefully. I do consider myself a liberal, Chris says. To me, that means letting others choose how they want to live, taking care of our community in a fair, just, and democratic manner so we can live how we choose. All I see now is one side trying to game the system. But on the other hand, Brandy in Urbana says the liberal label makes me think of the civil rights era when MLK Jr., as we just heard, said that liberals who were willing to play both sides were more dangerous than those who sat firmly on the side of the oppressor. He said liberals were more committed to order than to justice, and I think this still stands. Liberalism to me, Brandy says, means someone who is willing to admit there's a problem, but not willing to make the necessary change to resolve it. Instead, they kick the can down the road with Band-Aids and makeup. They're not willing to ruffle feathers enough to demand a real solution. When a boot is on someone's neck, a liberal is satisfied by the boot becoming a gentler shoe instead. Thank you, Brandy, Christopher, Chris, and Terry. If you want to join us, 800-222-9455. We are speaking with Kevin Schultz, history professor at UIC. His book is Why Everyone Hates White Liberals, Including White Liberals. Again, 800-222-9455. It's the 21st Show. We'll be right back. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking with Kevin Schultz, author of Why Everyone Hates White Liberals, Including White Liberals. He's also a professor in history, religious studies, and Catholic studies at the University of Illinois, Chicago. If you want to join us today, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. And let's go now to Gordon, calling from Northern Illinois on line two. Gordon, thanks for holding, and thanks for calling in.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. What I find amazing in the discussion about these terms is that everything has been so commodified that they actually lack any real relevance to their original historical roots or their political reality. For example, when people say that he's a communist, I tell them, well, tell me what communism is. And then they'll say something about totalitarianism. And I say, no. Communism, as defined by Marx, was an economic term. And then they'll say, oh, you're a socialist. I said, well, what about the roads, law enforcement, public education, libraries? These are all socialized enterprises that we agreed to support. So in many ways, I think the commodification and the advent of social media and such is diluting any real reality of these terms, and people begin to sort of make abstract concepts universal, and they're really quite specific in a lot of ways. And finally, the other thing is that with the advent of AI, of course, and what we're seeing right now is a profound transition in the whole American culture, is that they're going to be able to provide us a Huxleyan universe where people will have exactly what they want, and those who, the oligarchs who control, will be able to do what they want without any input. And this is just because Americans seem to feel that economics are more important than the veracity and vitality of our republic. And, of course, talking about that means you have to have an understanding of the Constitution and the foundations of our republic. So that's what I'd like to make a comment on.
Thank you so much for calling in. I appreciate it. Kevin, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, sure. I think Gordon's point right there is spot on, especially about the uses and abuses of words and how they eventually get removed from their historical origins and take on separate meanings. All words that are rich and have significant deep meanings go through those times when they get reformulated and reimagined to better suit our time or that time that people are talking about. The interesting thing about liberalism, and Gordon referred to several other words that have this kind of history too, is how its enemies, so liberalism's enemies, have come to the fore to really put a shine on that word and redefine it in a way that has very little to do with its historical meaning. So this is the quote that you started us off with, Brian, when I was talking about, if you think liberalism is this, then you are that. And if you think liberalism is that, then you are this, calling it a Rorschach test on your own political beliefs. I think that's absolutely true. Most words have rich contestations over their meaning, and liberalism is one of them for sure. And that's why I love history, because we can go back and study these other iterations. Right now, with the word liberalism, though, I definitely think the right is winning in that a lot of people think that liberalism is the gateway drug to socialism, en route to communism, whatever those words might mean. But it's definitely embodies an elitist, a snobbery, a kind of latte drinking, Volvo driving kind of class, like the people that the Howard Dean or the anti-Howard Dean advertisers talked about. And that is definitely far away from the notion of what the root of the word means, which is individual freedom. And that's what liberals should be most about. So I think Gordon is spot on to recognize these transformations. And I think we do need to be careful about how we allow words to change meanings in so much as we can control it. And one interesting thing, going back to those texts that you were reading before Gordon got on the line, that I found really fascinating, was my book ends with a call to stop using the word liberal and stop embracing liberalism because its opponents have redefined it in ways that most liberals don't own. There have been dozens and dozens of books over the past several decades trying to revitalize liberalism. And as soon as my book comes about saying it's time to come up with a new word, all of a sudden, all these callers, all these people I go on and when I meet them across the country as I'm promoting this book, they proudly proclaim themselves to be liberals. I'm saying, where have you been for the last 25 years?
Right.
But it's nice that there is this revitalized energy for this phrase as soon as I come about calling for its demise.
Cass Sunstein, and I was going to play a clip. Unfortunately, I don't want to take the time because we've only got 10 minutes left. But The West Wing had this moment in season 7 where Jimmy Smits, playing the man who was running against a Democrat, against Alan Alda, gives this impassioned defense of liberalism. People should Google it. You can just search for Santos defends liberalism, West Wing, or something like that. It is, you know, what I would imagine liberal people would want to hear and how they conceive of themselves here. So talk a little bit more briefly about that argument, and then maybe we can get a couple more callers in about the idea that, you know, maybe it's time to give up on liberalism and find a new marketing. Because I can hear people saying, won't conservatives just find a new way to brand whatever it is? Progressivism will become the new liberalism and so on?
Sure, but it'll have its moments before that happens. That great Alan Alda versus Jimmy Smits story from 2000, and I think it was 2005, where in the West Wing, Jimmy Smits says, "How dare you call me a liberal? What a liberal is. What did we do? Well, we freed the slaves. We gave women the right to vote. We established Social Security. We established Medicare and Medicaid. And so if you hurl that label at me, I will pick it up and wear it like a proud badge of honor." And all of a sudden, everybody applauds and everybody wants to be a liberal. But in the real world, a real candidate running for president named Hillary Clinton was asked a couple of years later in 2007 if she was a liberal. And she said, that word used to mean somebody was for freedom, but now it's come to mean that you're just a socialist. So I prefer to be a progressive or something like that. So in the real world, everybody wanted to raise up with Jimmy Smits and claim to be a liberal, but the word had taken on so much baggage over the last 50 years that politicians today, and going back to 2007 when Hillary Clinton said that, they couldn't really own up to what it meant to be a liberal because it had too much baggage in the time. So liberals ever since then have really struggled, or the Democratic Party especially, have really struggled to come up with a word to signify a way to say, I'm for individual freedom, but I want government regulations to push back on the power of big business. Kamala Harris, in the last presidential election, all she talked about was how her mom told her that she didn't fall out of a coconut tree. So we get the cover of New York Magazine showing her with a bunch of coconuts. So that's not exactly a really deep philosophical tradition that replaces liberalism to talk about coconuts. Biden tried Biden economics or Bidenomics or however it was, but it was very clumsy. President Barack Obama tried to talk about how you didn't build that, when he was telling the rich sort of one percenters that they didn't build the roads that their trucks drove on. They didn't build the state public universities that their employees were educated in. They didn't build the kind of hospitals that their workers would go to if they got injured on the job. But you didn't build that was not sort of a way of understanding a deep-rooted philosophy. All of these people were afraid to use the word liberal. And so it's time to come up with some sort of replacement that, that people are not afraid to use to sort of counterbalance the opposite argument, which might be free market or laissez-faire. And all of this has coalesced about a new word that's only been around for 10 years, but it's remarkably powerful, which is MAGA. And the left and the Democrats don't really have anything to counter that kind of vision.
Do you see abundance? Yeah. You know, the Ezra Klein, Derek Thompson wrote that book. Do you see abundance as sort of the an attempt at what you're talking about there?
Yeah, right now I think the Democratic Party is in a civil war. And I think on one side you do get these abundance liberals, which is sort of Ezra Klein and Derek Thompson, these great journalists who are making the argument that it's regulations that are keeping down the economy. And we need to have sort of, their great example is let fewer regulations on housing so that we can have more housing so that housing costs go down and there are fewer unhoused people. And this argument has been tried before. Back in the 80s and 90s, these people were called Atari Democrats because they were saying, no, we need to invest in technology because technology is gonna be the way to pursue a greener and better future for people. That has its limits, I think, as far as people really feeling that by deregulating the housing industry, it's actually going to make affordable housing. That's on one side. These are sort of the centrists. And on the other side, you get sort of the people that I'm calling in my book social democrats or democratic socialists. But the social democrats are making the argument that we really need to address the sort of deeper rooted problems within capitalism. We need to create maybe a billionaire's tax so that people who make $1 billion or have $1 billion get taxed at these incredibly higher rates than the rest of Americans, because they're still going to be able to enjoy life and buy yachts and stuff like that. But nonetheless, that wealth will then get pushed down. So I think right now, and we're seeing it today in the primaries within the Democratic Party, you get the sort of abundance liberals who are pushing back and fighting for power of the Democratic Party with the social Democrats. And those are sort of what's vying for power in the Democratic Party right now. And that's what's going to be at the forefront of pushing back against the Republicans and the MAGA and the Trumpists in the next couple of elections.
Just a few minutes left. You see this playing out in the races in Illinois, where people are going to the polls today, right? We can take the Senate race as one example in the way that, say, Raja Krishnamurti and Robin Kelly and Juliana Stratton are all trying to position themselves and, perhaps more to the point, position each other in the minds of the voters, right?
Oh, that's perfectly put, because all this money that's come in from the super PACs and things is trying to imagine Raja as, you know, just a big business guy who's going to be business friendly and embrace free market policies and stuff like that, while Juliana Stratton, and they sort of have forgotten about Robin Kelly, but she's a major Democratic candidate who's vying to replace Dick Durbin in the Senate as well, in certain sort of more radical light. So yes, I mean, we can see these in almost every election, even the House elections that go down, especially in the 7th and 9th districts, which are getting a lot of media attention right now. They're trying to say, no, this is sort of a more centrist candidate and I'm the true radical voice for change. Whereas other people are saying, I'm the responsible centrist candidate who's going to actually affect change. And you're just a radical who's going to push the party too far to the left, where you're going to lose the center of votes. This is exactly what we're seeing in today's election.
All right. Where do you see is there an example of or a time in history when sort of liberalism since the great, you know, conservative, since the civil rights era, when African-American civil rights activists were talking it down, since the 60s, people were talking it down? What has worked, right? You mentioned the things that didn't work, Bidenomics, Obamanomics, however you want to phrase it. What has worked?
Well, what's been interesting, it's something that I said earlier, where the policies of liberalism actually work, but the language of liberals and liberalism doesn't work. So it is a little bit more than just marketing, but I think marketing strategies are key to some of this. So if we look back to Joe Biden, for instance, and his two signature policies, the Great Infrastructure Act and the Inflation Readjustment Act, these were huge infusions of capital into places where the economy was struggling and where the economy was suffering. And they actually built factories in really interesting places, red states traditionally in the South, where workers were hurting. And so he actually wanted to take some of the initiatives of liberalism. And these were welcome and they were invited and they were generally pretty successful, but he did not market this well. He didn't put a sign on all of the factories that were being built saying Joe Biden built this or celebrate a new day for liberalism or anything like that. He just did the work and put his head down quietly and allowed it to be sort of forgotten in a lot of ways. So I do think there's a way that the policies of liberalism are still very popular in the American population, but the words of liberalism are not. So it'll be up to campaign candidates, it'll be up to the charismatic candidates that rise to the fore to reframe this for the American population so that they can understand what these politicians are actually trying to do. At the end of my book, I sort of go through a run of names that might possibly work. I have a great story that I tell about how my daughter and I were driving through Wisconsin on a hockey tournament for her, and she was taking Latin in high school, and we went through her Latin dictionary to see if any Latin-rooted words would fit as a replacement for liberalism, and we came up empty-handed. I sort of suggest, and I want some points for this, that social democracy might be the next great phrase. I want points because I sort of said it before this wave of getting elected in New York City, or maybe the new mayor of Seattle calls herself a social democrat. I see this voices on the left, and this is where a lot of power of the left is trying to take the Democratic Party. So we'll see if that actually has any sticking power. But I do think this is something that the Democratic Party will have to search for.
The book is Why Everyone Hates White Liberals, Including White Liberals. The author is Kevin Schultz. Thanks so much. I really appreciate your time today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Brian, and thanks for all the callers. Great questions, everybody.
All right, that is it for us today. Coming up tomorrow on the program, we're going to have a recap of the election results and what they mean for the general election in the fall. We'll be talking with Dan Petrella of the Chicago Tribune. Again, polls are open until 7 o'clock tonight across Illinois if you want to vote today. And that is it for us. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield and Jose Zepeda. Our digital producer, Colson Kahn, technical direction and engineering from Jason Croft and Steve Mork, and Reginald Hardwick's our news director. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.